The reason why people started asking me to give speeches has to do with my work in developing the GNU operating system, starting in 1984. In 1992, when the kernel Linux was made free software, it was added, it essentially filled the last gap in GNU. So the resulting GNU/Linux operating system is what has become rather popular. And of course, the important thing about that system is that it's free software. Otherwise, it would be just another operating system. However, free software is not what I'm here to speak about today. I'm here to speak about legal restrictions that threaten every programmer's ability to develop software and threaten every computer user as well. I'm talking about patents on software ideas. It's not a matter of patenting programs. You'll hear people use that term. It's a very misleading term because these patents do not cover each one a specific program. If they did, they would be harmless. But what makes them a significant issue is that they're much broader than that. A patent doesn't cover one specific program. It covers an idea that could be implemented in that program and in 50 or 1,000 other programs, in each case combined with other ideas. To understand this issue, to think carefully and clearly about patents, the first thing you need to do is forget about a term that you've probably heard, the term, quote, intellectual property, unquote. That term is a sort of catch-all that lumps together various different laws, and altogether there is effectively nothing that they have in common. The partial resemblances among these laws are a small part of them. Mostly these laws are different, and their public effects, the public policy issues they raise are different. For instance, copyright law and patent law have almost nothing in common. So if you learn something about copyright law, you should assume it's not true of patents. And if you learn something about patent law, you should assume it's not true of copyrights. If you make this assumption, you'll almost always be right. So the term, quote, intellectual property, unquote, is harmful, both because of the bias, it says, think of this as a kind of property, and because of the overgeneralization, inviting people to lump these different laws together, and that is fatal for thoughtful consideration of the issues of any one of these laws. So to give you a basic picture of copyrights and patents so you can see that they're totally different, let me explain some of the big differences. First of all, a copyright covers a specific work. It covers the details of expression of a work and does not cover any ideas. Ideas are excluded in copyright law. Second, whereas patents, a patent covers an idea. Every patent states an idea and says, this idea is something you're not allowed to do. Now, another big difference is copyrights exist automatically. Anything that's written is copyrighted, unless it's just in some countries, a compilation of facts based compiled in a systematic way would not be copyrightable because there's no author has decided any details of expression. But a patent is issued by a patent office in response to an application. The application fee is pretty expensive, but the fees to the lawyers to draw up the application so that it's likely to be accepted are even more expensive. Now, anything that's written is copyrighted. It doesn't have to meet any standard of profundity. However, supposedly a patent application, for a patent to be issued, the idea has to be new, useful, and unobvious. Some countries use different words that mean more or less the same thing as that. However, in practice, it ends up meaning unobvious to somebody with an IQ of 80. This is not because the patent examiners have an IQ of 80. It's because they're following a system which systematically gives that result. And another interesting difference is that copyrights last a tremendously, absurdly long time. Copyrights can last 150 years in some cases with the law as it is today. But patents expire after 20 years. However, even 20 years is a long time if we look at computers. 20 years ago, there was no World Wide Web. The Internet was new. The Macintosh was new. And the IBM PC was a fairly new, very weak toy. And finally, copyrights covers copying. So if you spent a year in a cave and came out with a manuscript of a novel, and during that year someone else had published an identical novel, you would have a defense against an accusation of copyright infringement. You could prove that you had no chance to copy that novel because you couldn't see it in your cave. But a patent is an absolute monopoly on the use of the idea stated in the patent. And that means that even if you could prove you had the idea on your own, it would be irrelevant. You'd still be forbidden to use it. So, with these, now you've got an idea of how the frameworks are completely different. Of course, every detail is different too. So, anyone who suggests that you think about, quote, the issue of intellectual property, unquote, is either confused or trying to confuse you. It makes no sense to consider these two different issues together. So, most of the time when people describe the patent system, they're people who work in the patent system, and they have a vested interest in it. For instance, they might be patent bureaucrats. They might, in other words, work in the patent office. They might be patent lawyers, or they might be from the patent department of some large corporation. And since they have an interest in patents, they describe the system in a way that's designed to make you think they're good, a one-sided way. The magazine The Economist once compared the patent system to, quote, a time-consuming lottery, unquote. And if you've seen publicity for lotteries, you know how it works. It focuses on an unlikely possibility that you would win and ignores the probable outcome that you lose, and therefore thereby contrives to present a false picture of what's likely to happen to you in the lottery without telling anything that's specifically a lie. So you probably couldn't sue them for lying, but nonetheless they're deceiving people. The publicity for the patent system lottery follows a similar principle. It generally describes the system from the point of view of those who win. It explains what it's like to apply for a patent, to get one, and then walk down the street with a patent in your pocket, and every so often pull it out and point it at somebody and say, "Give me your money." So, to counterbalance that bias, I'm going to describe the patent system from the other point of view, from the point of view of its numerous victims, those who want to develop or use software. By the way, when you confront a patent lawyer with the probability that he or she is biased, the lawyer typically does something that lawyers often do, namely subtly sidestep the issue and give a response that at first sight appears to disprove the charge, but when carefully studied, proves to be irrelevant. They'll say, I'm not always in favor of every patent. I work for defendants too. Now, that may well be true, but it's beside the point. They may not be always in favor of every patent, but they're in favor of having a patent system that issues lots of patents. They're like mercenaries who are glad to work for any side, but they want to have a lot of war. So, suppose that you are... Yes? Suppose that you are developing software and you're in a country that foolishly has the policy of allowing software idea patents, and you want to work carefully with the patent system's rules to make sure that you can lawfully do what you're doing. What do you have to do? Well, the first thing you have to do is find all the patents that might restrict what you put into your program. This is impossible because patent applications are being considered in secret by the patent office, and you can't find out what they are, but they may result in patents issuing. If you're carrying a personal tracking device, please switch it off. They've already tracked you here, so you don't need to keep it on anymore for them to have total surveillance of your movements. So these patents may be issued tomorrow or next week or next year that will then make your program forbidden, and there's no way you can find this out now. This is not just a theoretical possibility. It's happened to me, to my project. In 1984, the Compress program was written, a program for data compression, and it used the LZW data compression algorithm, which the author of Compress had read about in a journal. This was back when we thought the purpose of computer science journals was to tell us about techniques we could use in our work. And at that time, there was in fact no patent in the US on the LZW compression algorithm. A patent was issued, however, in 1985. The patent holder cunningly did not immediately tell people that you're not allowed to use Compress. Instead, the patent holder thought, let's wait a few years, let them dig their holes deeper so that when we attack them, they won't be able to run away. But by the late 80s, we knew that it was not safe to use Compress. So we began looking for some other way to do it. And I announced in public that we were looking for some other data compression algorithm that we could safely use. And someone in Australia wrote to me, said, I've been developing this data compression program for a year. It looks pretty good, and I'm going to offer it to you. We were about a week away from releasing this program when I saw the New York Times on the day of the weekly patents column, which only happened two or three times a year, I think. And it said somebody had just got a patent for, quote, inventing a new way to compress data, unquote. And so I got worried and I thought, we better look at this. And sure enough, that patent covered the algorithm used in this program we were going to release. So that program died before it was born. I suppose it could have been even worse. We could have released it and a year later that patent could have been issued. Well, we kept looking, and eventually someone worked out another algorithm, which became the basis of the program GZIP. And the code in GZIP is also, I believe, used in WinZIP, which means that it's now the standard way for people to compress data when they have files they want to compress. So this sounds like a happy ending, but I'll tell you more about it later. So you can't find out about all the patents that may prohibit something that you're putting in your program. But you can find the issued patents. Those are all published by the patent office. You could get the whole stack. In the European patent office, that's 35,000. In the US, it's hundreds of thousands, which is too much for you to read. So you're going to have to search for the patents that are relevant to what you're doing. This is something you can do more or less effectively, but not completely. You won't find everything. There was a patent in the U.S. covering the technique called natural order recalculation in spreadsheets. The idea is recalculate each cell after the ones it depends on, not before. And this way, you get consistent results. No, really, the first spreadsheet, I believe, recalculated top to bottom always because it was written to run in a very small toy computer, and they had to squeeze it as much as possible. When computers got somewhat bigger, then there was room for things like natural order recalculation. Anyway, it was patented, and somebody once asked me for a copy of that patent. So I looked in our file to find the number, then I looked in the drawer and pulled out that patent and copied it and mailed it to him. A week later, when he got it, he said to me, "I think you sent me the wrong patent. This is something about compilers." So I figured, what's wrong? I looked in the file, got the number, pulled out that patent, and it said, "A technique for compiling formulas into object code." So I wonder, did we get the wrong patent? Is there a wrong number in my file? So I began looking at the claims of this patent, and sure enough, it was the natural order recalculation patent. But it didn't say that. It said a technique for compiling formulas into object code. Now, this patent did not mention the term spreadsheet, and it didn't mention the term natural order recalculation. The algorithm that you use to do this is called topological sort. And this patent described separately several dozen ways you could arrange the details to do topological sort. But it didn't mention the term topological sort either. So if you had been searching, if you were writing a spreadsheet and you'd been searching for relevant patents, you wouldn't have found this one unless somebody told you he was getting sued. However, you would find a lot of patents that relate to the various things that you're thinking of doing in your program. What next? You have to study each of them carefully to figure out what it's talking about and just what it prohibits you from doing. And that you won't be able to do on your own because patents are written in twisted legal language and the words don't mean what you think they mean. So you're going to have to work with a lawyer to figure out and spend a lot of time and money to figure out just what you're not allowed to do. So you see, this is why they want to have lots of patents, because then they'll get lots of business from you like this. Now, 20 years ago, the Australian government commissioned a study of the patent system, which concluded that there was no indication that patents were of any benefit to Australia. And they said that if not for international pressure, they would recommend abolishing patents. But given there was international pressure, they would recommend making patents narrower in scope, harder to get, and last a shorter period of time. And these recommendations might be very useful today. I believe the study was done by someone named Mandeville, so you could try to look it up that way. And in particular, it found that one of the stated purposes of the patent system, which was to get ideas published rather than kept secret so that other people could learn from them, was a failure, and that hardly ever did engineers read a patent. And they quoted an engineer as saying, "I can't recognize my own inventions in patentees." Now, I've seen this in my personal experience. One Paul Heckel developed a program that made it possible to usefully fit more data in a limited size screen. And it had some interesting features, and he made use of them to get a couple of patents. Now, when I once spent an hour looking at claim number one of these patents, trying to find some simple way of describing what this patent covered. And I couldn't find anything simpler than to paraphrase the words of the patent itself, which were so complex, even they were only three lines or so, that I couldn't keep them in my mind. they didn't make enough sense for me to be able to keep them in my mind. So I'm not saying they were meaningless, just that there was a bunch of things that I couldn't find any overarching way to describe them all. So the only way I could think of them was as all these details. Apparently, Haeckel couldn't quite understand it either. Because when he first saw HyperCard, it didn't look anything like his program. It didn't have the same features. So he never dreamed that it had anything to do with his patent, with his patents. But his lawyer said that the way the patents were written, they could be read as applying to HyperCard too. So he began threatening Apple. And when that didn't immediately cause Apple to fork over a truck of money, he started threatening Apple's customers as well. And eventually, Apple reached a settlement with him, which is secret, so we don't know whether he managed to be very successful with this parasitism or not. It's a bit like sexual predators. They say, don't tell anybody what I've just made you do. So once when I was giving this speech in California, Haeckel was in the audience, and he jumped up at this point and he said, that's not true. I just didn't understand the scope of my protection. Protection is a propaganda word that patent lawyers and copyright lawyers love to use. You know, they'll never say a patent covers this. They'll say the patent protection covers this. Well, think about that word on your own. I never use it. Anyway, he said, I didn't understand the scope of my protection. And I said, I thought a couple of seconds and I said to him, yes, that's what I said. And at that point, he sat down and didn't utter another word. If I had said no, he probably would have argued with me, but he didn't see a way to argue with yes. So that was my experience being heckled by Haeckel. So you're going to have to put a lot of work into talking with the lawyer to find out what the patent covers. And ultimately, the lawyer will tell you something structurally like this. If you do something in this area, you'll probably lose the lawsuit. If you do something in this area, there's a considerable probability you'll lose. And if you really want to be safe, stay out of this area. But keep in mind, there's a substantial element of chance in the outcome of any lawsuit. So now that you have predictable rules for how to do business, what are you really going to do? Well, for each patent, there are three possibilities, three things you might do. One is to avoid the patent, another is to get a license for the patent, and the third one is to overturn the patent. Each of these may or may not be possible based on independent factors. So, first of all, to avoid the patent. That means don't use the idea that's forbidden by the patent. So, what does that mean? Well, sometimes an algorithm or technique is patented, and that means you don't use the algorithm or technique. Well, that may be easy or hard. I once saw a patent covering a faster variant of the fast Fourier transform, FFT. Ran about twice as fast, so I was told. Well, if your program does an FFT once in a while, then you can use the ordinary FFT algorithm, and it'll be good enough. And that way you've avoided the patent and it's no sweat. On the other hand, if your program spends all of its time doing FFTs to try to give the user results in real time and it runs barely fast enough with the fast algorithm on an expensive computer, then you can't avoid it. But that's going to be a rare situation. However, there are times when avoiding even a specific algorithm is more or less impossible. And that's when that algorithm is necessary to implement a standard. Consider the LZW compression algorithm. We avoided that for the job of compressing files. We gave them another data compression program that they wouldn't get sued for, and it ran faster, and it compressed data tighter. It was better in every way. So the people who just thought, I want to compress my file, they all switched to it. But then consider implementing PostScript. The PostScript specification says there's an operator to do LZW compression and one for uncompression. We had another different, better algorithm, but those wouldn't do the job because they were not completely compatible. The compressed output looks different with GZIP. So we couldn't use that algorithm to implement PostScript. So what could we do? Well, we just barely slipped by. It turns out that the way the patents was written, it doesn't cover uncompression by itself. It only covers uncompression when combined in the same system with compression. So we could implement just uncompression, and it turns out that users mostly don't want to ask their printer to compress anything. They only want to ask it to uncompress. So we couldn't fully implement PostScript, but we implemented enough of it to satisfy the users in practice. That was a narrow escape. And then what about supporting GIF files? GIF format for images, which you've all seen on the web, that uses LZW also. There's no other way to make a real GIF file. So what could we do? Well, it didn't take long for somebody to design another image format called PNG for Pings Not GIF, which uses the GZIP algorithm for its compression. And we said to people, stop using GIF. Help everyone escape from this threat. Because it was not just software developers who were being attacked, but anyone that had a website that they thought they could squeeze money out of. And if the website had GIF files, the patent holder was saying, if you can't prove that every one of these GIF files was made with a properly licensed program, then we can sue you. So we were saying to people, please help everyone escape. Help the whole net escape from this threat by switching away from GIF. And the user said, well, maybe I could use PNG, but the browsers don't support it yet. And the browser developer said, we could implement PNG, but the users aren't asking for it. And all in all, it was like trying to ask everyone in Australia to switch from English to Swahili. GIF had become a de facto standard, and to get people to change a de facto standard is very, very hard. So we thought that JPEG was a safe alternative, but a couple of years ago, someone discovered that he had in his hands a patent that appeared to cover JPEG, and he started threatening people. Now, JPEG is not a de facto standard. JPEG is an official standard issued by a standards committee. The committee had someone look at the patent and then said that, in their opinion, the patent does not cover JPEG. So, who will decide? A court will decide, because there's a lawsuit going on now. These are rather light instances of the problem, one patent or two patents covering the standard. GIF was actually covered by two patents, both covering the LZW data compression algorithm. Now, you might think this is not supposed to happen, that something gets patented twice. But to see that they're patented twice, that the two patents cover the same thing, you have to think about them carefully together. Because after all, this is just mathematics. They like to pretend it isn't, but it really is. And in mathematics, you can reformulate something in a way that looks quite different. Please wake up. If somebody else falls asleep, then you'd be accused of sleeping together in public. So it actually would have taken a lot of work to check for this kind of thing. In other fields, it's easier. You know, if there are patents on chemical processes, one can see do they take the same chemicals as inputs? Do they produce the same result? That gives you a quick clue to whether it's important to compare these two patent applications, for instance. But in software, there's no clue to that. So it would have taken too much work. You see, patent examiners get on the average 17 hours per patent application in the U.S. In Europe, I'm told the system is that the patent examiner gets 1 point for every application, either accepted or rejected, except they have to do a lot more work to reject one, so they usually accept it. Patent offices tend to be funded by the application fees, so they think of the patent applicants as their customers, and they think it's their mission to provide good service to their customers, which is a betrayal of their actual mission. In any case, I won't say that it was because some patent examiner made a mistake that these two patents were both issued on the same algorithm. And this wasn't the only case. Remember that program that died before it was born? That algorithm was patented twice, too. So apparently this happens pretty often, which shows that it's impossible for a patent office to keep track of what it's doing if it tolerates software patents. In any case, that's a fairly light example of the problem. Now take a look at the MPEG-2 video format, which is covered, well, I saw a list of patents that cover it, and it included 39 different U.S. patents, as well as some patents from other countries. It took longer to negotiate a scheme for anyone to get a license to all these patents than it took to develop the standard. What's the use of standards that people are not free to implement? So in these cases, to avoid the patent is nearly fatal to your project. Sometimes what's patented is a feature. Then you avoid the patent by not supporting the feature. Around 1990, the users of the word processor Xyrite got a downgrade in the mail. It took out a feature which they had discovered was patented. The feature was you could define a few characters as an abbreviation, say a few letters. And whenever you type those few letters followed by a punctuation, those letters would replace themselves with whatever expansion you had selected and defined before. So this is a convenience for typing. But then in the 1980s, someone had patented this and started threatening them. Their first idea was to try to negotiate a license, but the patent holder kept changing his demands. Eventually, they concluded it was useless to negotiate with that person, and they took the feature out instead and sent the users a downgrade. They wrote to me about this because they'd heard that my text editor, Emacs, had a similar feature back in the 1970s. So eventually, I'm glad to say, that particular patent was actually overturned on the strength, partly, of the work I had done in Emacs. So that's one software idea patent down and hundreds of thousands to go. Well, I'm glad to know I've had at least one patentable idea in my life, but I'd much rather that it hadn't been possible to patent such a thing. Anyway, if you look at your word processor, you'll see hundreds of features, each one of them being at least one idea, maybe several different ideas you could find in one feature. There may be different ways to slice it, the same feature, to get ideas, that any one of which could be said to be used if you implement that feature. So if you take out one nice feature, maybe the users will still think your program is usable. But once you've taken out 20 or 30 features, they're likely to say, this word processor is crap. Often you can avoid one patent, but the difficulty is to avoid the many patents. You know, it wasn't that hard to find a compression algorithm different from LZW, but there were dozens of patents to be avoided in that field, and it was rather hard to find the GZIP algorithm that avoided them all. And sometimes a patent is so broad that the idea of avoiding it is hopeless. The entire field of public key encryption was covered in the U.S. by a very broad patent. Until 1997, the field was essentially off limits to almost everyone. And this is a very good example of how it's not just the trivial patents that are harmful. People often focus their attention on the ridiculous patents, and I'm telling you about some of them. But I wouldn't say that LZW was a trivial idea. Nonetheless, the patent has been very harmful. And certainly, the idea of public key encryption was not trivial. That's a brilliant idea. But issuing a patent on this was terribly harmful to society. So that's the approach of trying to avoid the patent. It may be possible, it may not. The second option is to get a license to use the idea. This may or may not be an option. Patent holders don't have to offer a license. A patent holder can say, I don't want you competing with me, I'm shutting you down. I once got a letter from someone whose family business was making casino games, computerized, of course. And he was being threatened by a patent holder who also made casino games, who was telling him, you have to shut down. He sent me that patent, and I found the first claim rather interesting. It was a network containing multiple computers, where each computer supports more than one different game and is capable of handling more than one game session at a time. That's all. Now, I'm sure that back in the 80s, various universities set up laboratories of workstations that had some kind of windowing facilities and installed more than one game. And if so, they were doing exactly what this patent says was an invention. They probably didn't think that they had invented anything, let alone think that this particular combination of things that they might have done was a single idea. But nonetheless, a patent was issued on this. You see, the patent system thinks that if somebody made a machine that does something once, and someone else makes another machine that will do it n times, that's an invention. The patent system thinks that if there are machines that'll do A and machines that'll do B, that a machine that'll do either A or B is an invention. We think of these things as the while statement and the switch statement. But they, by their rules, consider this an invention. So they systematically issue patents that we would consider ridiculous, and whether they are legally invalid, I don't know. The courts might follow the same standards. In any case, despite the ridiculousness of this patent, there was no help I could offer him because he didn't have the money to go to court. All he could do was shut down, and that's what happened. However, many patent holders will offer you a license. The natural order recalculation patent was being licensed for 5% of the sales price of a spreadsheet. Now, maybe you could sign one such license, but what if you needed 20 of them? And then what happens when patent holder number 21 comes along? Well, these are actually a ridiculous exaggeration because people in business told me that, practically speaking, two or three of these would be enough to make your business fail. There are, however, some software developers for which it is easy to get licenses most of the time. These are the mega corporations, because each of them has a lot of patents in the fields where it's active and uses these to force everyone else to cross-license with them. So the mega corporations in a field form an exclusive club. They're up at the top, and the rest of us are at the bottom looking up at the cliff with very little chance of ever getting up there. IBM published an article about this in Think Magazine, issue number 5, 1990, about IBM's patent portfolio. It said that IBM got two kinds of benefit from its 9,000 or so U.S. patents. One was collecting money, but the other, which it said was perhaps an order of magnitude greater, was gaining access to the patents of others. And that means using cross-licensing so it can't be stopped from doing the things that others have patented. Now, this measurement is interesting. You see, the patent system is like a time-consuming lottery. Its effects on a small business vary wildly based on circumstances. But IBM being so big, IBM can measure the average. And the average that IBM measured is that patents will cause you 10 times as much trouble as they ever give you benefit. Unless you're as big as IBM, and then you can use cross-licensing to avoid the trouble. So IBM was, by saying the benefit of using cross-licensing to get access to the patents of others, IBM was telling us the size of the trouble it avoided. So if you're as big as IBM, you don't have this trouble. All you get is the benefit, the money. But if you're not as big as IBM, you can't, and you don't have 9,000 U.S. patents, you can't force cross-licensing the way IBM does, and then the trouble really happens to you. So IBM has given us a measurement that for smaller companies, the harm is going to be 10 times the benefit. Now, of course, it couldn't be that way for everyone because the money that some lose has to go to someone else. Now, of course, part of it goes to the lawyers, but still is not going to be nine-tenths of it. So the way it balances out is the mega corporations avoid the bad part. They get just the benefit, and that's where it all goes, you see. So for the mega corporations, it's just benefit. For the smaller and medium-sized companies, the harm is 10 times the good. And where that goes is to the lawyers and to the mega corporations. Now, there are many smaller companies that are trying to do this because they know it's their only defense. They say to their employees, get us some patents. We've got to have something to shoot back with. But they have no chance of getting enough patents to have much hope of succeeding. Suppose I had two patents and one points there and one points there. And then someone over here points a patent at me and says, give me your money. My two patents are going to be useless for fighting back because they don't point at the right place. Each patent covers a certain thing. So these companies, you know, a small company won't get 9,000 patents. If it's lucky, it might get 9, and that won't be enough. So once in a while, it could be able to force cross-licensing with one of those patents, but most of the time, it won't be able to. Meanwhile, with this patent pointing over there, I might notice, hey, those guys over there, they're not attacking me, but I could attack them. And this kind of opportunistic bullying is very common. So if your employer is saying to you, get us some patents, we've got to have something to shoot back with, here's the response I suggest you give. I understand fully why we need patents to use for defensive purposes, but I don't know who the management of this company will be in 5 or 10 or 15 years. It may be acquired by Microsoft for all I know. So please, let's put it in writing that these patents will only be used for defensive purposes, never for aggression. And say that publicly and raise a discussion within the company. And you may succeed in enabling that company to get patents without posing itself a threat to others. The worst danger is often if the company fails, which most startups do, of course, and then the patents will be auctioned off, as, for instance, David Chaum's patent was auctioned off and will fall into the hands of a patent parasite. So it's very important to realize how cross-licensing works for the big companies, because that's the flaw in an argument that is often presented to us, the claim that patents, quote, protect, unquote, the, quote, small inventor, unquote. This argument is based on a scenario which I'll now present. Let's suppose there is a brilliant designer of whatever who has spent years working in his attic to develop a better way to do whatever, and now it's working, so he's going to go into business to make them, and his business will be a tremendous success because his whatever is so good. And it would be a tremendous success except for one thing. The big companies will immediately compete with him. They will take all the market away from him, and because of that, it will fail and he'll starve. Now, this scenario is a series of unlikelihoods. First of all, most progress in high-tech fields is made by people working in the field, talking with other people. Second, if he's a brilliant engineer, that doesn't mean he knows how to run a business. Most new businesses fail within a few years, and his will probably fail too, because he won't know how to run it. But let's suppose he also is good at running a business. Then it might succeed. After all, there are plenty of small businesses out there, even though most new businesses fail. It might succeed because if he knows how to run a business, he will use the advantages of small business and do the kinds of things where they have an advantage. Just because there are big companies, that doesn't mean all small companies go out of business from their competition. Even if the big companies do compete with him, he only needs a small fraction of the market to be a success as a small business. But let's suppose that it does fail, despite all his ability. Well, if he's that brilliant in engineering and knows how to run a business too, he can surely get a job, so he won't starve. But unlikely as this scenario is, let's suppose that it happens. The argument says the patent system will change the outcome because our genius can get a patent, and then when IBM wants to compete with him, he can say, IBM, you can't compete with me because I've got this patent and it protects me. And IBM says, oh, not again. Here's what really happens. IBM says, oh, you have a patent. How nice. Well, we have this patent, this one, and this one, and this one that cover other aspects of the product you are making. So sign a cross-license agreement with us and we'll go away friends. And our genius, because he understands business, realizes he has no choice. He signs, and IBM proceeds to compete with him, just as if he had never had a patent. So this myth is false. The patent system does not, quote, protect, unquote, the small inventor. It might protect him from competition from you, but not from IBM, not from the large companies, which are the ones that, in this scenario, he most has to fear. So what good is it? Now, even IBM can't make every patent holder cross-license, because there are patent parasite companies that don't make any products except for threats to sue. All they have is patents. And they go around looking for whoever looks like a juicy target and pull out the patents and say, give me your money. Now, patent lawyers tell us how nice it is to have a patent system in your field, but they've arranged not to have one in their field. There are no patents on how to word a threatening letter or how to file a lawsuit or how to persuade a judge or a jury. So the result is that even IBM can't get a patent that will cover what these parasites are doing. So IBM sometimes just has to pay them off to go away. But IBM probably figures that their competitors also have to pay these parasites off and get them to go away. So they figure that this is just part of the cost of doing business and everyone has to pay. Meanwhile, there are some software developers who find it particularly hard to get patent licenses. That's we free software developers. Because a patent license usually requires a payment per copy, and we can't count the copies. If the license required me to pay one millionth of a dollar per copy, the total amount of money might be in my pocket, but I can't comply with the requirements because I can't calculate how much I have to pay. Now, the patent holder can offer whatever conditions he likes. So he could offer a license for a lump sum. That's something that at least theoretically I could do. But the payment is usually a lot of money, like $100,000. The reason free software has been a success is that we've shown that we don't need to have money to develop software. But we need money to pay money. If we have to pay money for permission to develop software and serve the public, we won't be able to serve the public anymore. So that's the option of getting a patent license to use the idea that's patented. The third option is to overturn the patent. Whether you can do this depends on whether there's an argument you can make, and that depends on facts from years ago. You have to prove that the idea was made known to the public before the patent application. And the result was that in effect, the dice were rolled way back when, and if they came out favorable to you and you can prove it now, then you have a case to make. If you don't have a case to make, it's useless to try to overturn the patent. If you do have a case to make, you can go to court, but it's likely to cost a lot of money. And therefore, whoever has the most money has the advantage, usually. Qualcomm was the defendant a few years back in a software patent lawsuit and lost and had to pay $13 million, of which $8 million went to pay the lawyers on both sides. If they had won, they probably would have had to pay only their lawyers, so I could guess that might have been around $4 million. The result is that if you don't have this much money, it's not an option. And thus, being attacked with a patent that is probably invalid can be a very devastating thing. It can destroy your business if it's a small business. A patent doesn't have to be probably valid to be a dangerous weapon. Patent lawyers, of course, will say that the system corrects its mistakes, that the invalid patents will get overturned, and they're just ignoring the mayhem that they cause on the way to getting overturned. So that's the third option, to overturn the patent. So there are these three things you could try to do for each patent. For each patent, you've got to deal with it one way or another. And each of these three things may or may not be possible, and the things that make them possible or not are different, which means that sometimes none of them is possible. And when that happens, your project is dead. Practically speaking, usually we don't try to find all the patents that might apply. And the reason is the penalties are worse if you know about the patent. So the result is you close your eyes and you go and you design your program. And at each step, at each design decision, chances are nothing happens. But there's a certain chance that you'll step on a patent and it'll explode and destroy your project. And because there are so many design decisions to make to develop a large program, it adds up to a lot of danger. It's not just once in a while that somebody will develop a program and find that it steps on a patent. Usually, it'll step on many patents. And the result is that when there are software idea patents, programming and the use of software even become dangerous. Now, people used to ask me a rather biased and deceptive question. They would say, engineers in other fields have been dealing with patents for decades. Why should software be an exception? Well, that question has a bias in it. That's a bias that there should be patents, that we had to prove somehow that we had to, that we could justify an exception, an assumption that all fields should be treated alike, which is ridiculous because each field ought to be treated in the way that benefits society to treat that field. The purpose of the patent system is to promote progress. And therefore, the right question to ask is, what differences between fields might have implications for wise patent policy in those fields? That's a way of putting this question without bias. So let me answer it. One very important difference between fields is in how patents relate to products. That's something that differs from field to field. They fall on a spectrum. Each field is somewhat spread out, of course, not a single point on the spectrum. The spectrum of how many patents will cover one product. At this extreme is our naive picture of the patent system. The picture that for each product there's one patent. This is a picture we get where if somebody designs a new product, then we think it won't be patented already. And just in that phrase, we're making the assumption that there's one that a patent covers a whole product. So it won't be patented already, and whoever designed this product could patent it. Patent it, again, the whole product. So this naive picture that there is one patent per product may have been true in the first half of the 19th century, but it's not true today. There was one field in which it used to be this way until a few years ago, and that's pharmaceuticals. They would patent the entire chemical formula of a drug. So if you developed a new drug, it couldn't be patented by somebody else already. And you could get the one and only patent on that drug. But it's not that way anymore. It's starting to change. Nowadays, someone who develops a new drug can find it's already covered by a broader patent. Still, however, pharmaceuticals is pretty close to that naive picture. Other fields of physical engineering are further away, and at the other extreme is software. Why is software at the other extreme? Because in the other fields, people are trying to design physical things, and they have to cope with the perversities of matter, and that plagues them with difficulties, which we don't have, because in software, we are designing structures out of ideal mathematical parts that do exactly what they're defined to do. If physical things don't do what they're designed to do, tough luck. If a program doesn't do what the design says to do, that means the computer's broken. So this means there are all sorts of problems we don't face. For instance, if I put an if statement inside of a while statement, I don't have to worry about whether the voltage drop through that while statement and the various other things around it will be too great and the if statement won't function right. I don't have to worry that this while statement will go around at a frequency that will make the if statement resonate and vibrate and that eventually it will crack or just wear away at its contacts with the while statement and eventually the signals won't pass right. I don't have to worry about whether the heat generated by the if statement can escape out through the while statement. I don't have to worry that it will repeat at an even faster frequency and generate radio frequency interference in other parts of the program. I don't have to worry about whether a corrosive fluid will get in between the if statement and the while statement and eat away at the contact so eventually it cracks or the signals don't pass or the voltage drop gets too high. And I don't have to worry about how, supposing this if statement should burn out or crack or corrode, I'm going to pull it out and remove it and put in a replacement if statement. And I don't have to worry about how I'm going to put the if statement inside the while statement in the first place when I'm building copies of this program. I don't have to design a factory to produce copies of this program. With physical products, often designing the factory to produce the product is a bigger job than designing the product and may constrain the design of the product. You have to design for manufacturability. But with software, if I want to manufacture copies of a program, I use a general purpose copier like CP or SCP or TAR or, you know, there are various general purpose copiers, and each one of them will copy any program. So there are so many difficulties I just don't have that engineers in all these physical fields face. The result is that the software field is inherently easier than any other field of engineering. But the intelligence range of people in the software field is, I presume, the same as the intelligence range of physical engineers. So what does this mean? Well, it means we do bigger projects. If you make it big enough, eventually the complexity of the overall project makes it challenging. It's not the individual ideas one by one. It's the overall complexity of the combination that's the challenge in the software field. So in physical fields, people do put together many ideas. This phenomenon of patent gridlock has been happening for a while. When the U.S. entered World War I, nobody in the U.S. could make a modern airplane. Because to do that, you had to use several ideas that were patented by different people that didn't get along. So nobody could get to use all of them. The U.S. government didn't like this and confiscated these patents, paying a lump sum to the patent holders, and then said, okay, everyone, make good airplanes. But that was just a few patents. With software, the problem gets much bigger because we put many more different things in one program. A physical system with a million different parts in its design is a gigantic project. It's the limit of what human beings can do. But a program with a million different parts in its design is ordinary. That's a few hundred thousand lines. A few people write that in a few years. We're doing that all the time. So the result is one program can combine far more ideas than one airplane, if you don't count the software in the airplane. And so the result is one program can be the victim of far more different patents than one physical product can be. That's why software is at that extreme in how patents relate to products. I used to have to ask people to look at their word processors and see how many features there were and imagine how many different patents could cover one program. But now we have one study for one particular program that gives us real information about this. The study concerns Linux, which is the kernel of the GNU/Linux system, just one part of the system, but a rather large program in its own right. And the study found 286 U.S. patents covering ideas implemented somewhere in Linux. I'm sure that number is out of date by now. It must be larger. That was a few months ago. And I saw another estimate that Linux was 0.25% of the entire GNU/Linux system. So we could multiply and estimate around 100,000 U.S. software idea patents covering ideas implemented somewhere in the whole system. This is a rough estimate. It wouldn't surprise me if it were as little as 30,000 or as much as 300,000. So now you see the problem, the danger of software idea patents. The system makes no sense because it's supposed to promote progress. But the big challenge of software development isn't from the individual ideas, it's from the complexity of combining so many in one program. So any system that encourages people artificially to have ideas by obstructing the real work of our field, which is combining many ideas together, defeats progress in the field. And there is economic modeling which shows that even aside from this, if you just look at research, that a patent system can retard progress when it's applied in a field that has incremental innovation. You can find this economic research, I warn you it's mathematical, in the site www.researchoninnovation.org. It comes from the Business School of MIT. And the paper is called patents.pdf. There's another paper showing that empirically, software idea patents in the U.S. caused a transfer of funds from research into patenting. So the system is harmful even in its own terms. Where it's supposed to produce a social benefit, instead it produces harm. But software idea patents are not just an economic issue. In most fields, whether to have patents is an economic issue. They only restrict a few companies fairly specialized. But software idea patents restrict everyone that uses a computer. Nowadays, a large fraction of all businesses use computers, and they are being restricted by software idea patents. In Europe, in the European Union, the Confederation of Associations of Small and Medium-Sized Businesses, which represents 2 million businesses, is against software idea patents. Their members are mostly not in the software field. They don't develop software, but they use computers and they do e-commerce. And they don't want to be tied up in a new bureaucracy that serves no purpose for society. I'm not one of those people who's against all regulation of business. Some regulation of business serves an important social need, like public health and preserving everybody's living standards and protecting the environment. These are important things. But it has to meet a standard of importance to justify tying everybody up in a new bureaucracy. If these businesses only knew what they're letting themselves in for, they'd be up in arms. Well, in Europe, they're starting to know. Now, a few weeks ago, I did something I rarely do. I was in a sort of debate. A patent lawyer spoke before me in favor of software idea patents. And he said that in other fields, patents are fit in naturally because those are mature industries. And when he was pressed to define mature, he said it meant that there were a few major players. So in the software field, we're used to the idea that there are very low barriers to entry, so lots of people can get into developing software. But software idea patents push the field towards being, quote, mature, unquote. Well, that word is a propaganda word. It suggests that it's both a normal and desirable outcome. After all, we want every child to grow up and become mature, right? So this is suggesting that the part of the goal is to kick out the small business from everything. It should be harder for small businesses to exist. So software idea patents are a failure in their own terms. They're an outrageous denial of the rights of every computer user, and they tie most businesses up in a new form of bureaucracy. They make absolutely no sense. In the U.S., software idea patents were the result of a court decision. It was never an issue for a real public debate. In the European Union, a broad movement against software idea patents has made it the subject of public debate. This movement started in the free software community, and I personally played a role in launching it. In the early 90s, I gave a lot of speeches in Europe. But it spread beyond the free software community to proprietary software developers and to developers of the many developers of private use software. And we've got support from economists. We have support from Deutsche Bank and various other large companies. So it's become a rather broad movement. And we persuaded the European Parliament to conclusively, across the board, vote amendments preventing software idea patents 1 year ago. The European Union is not very democratic, and the Parliament's decision was not the final result it would have been in the usual parliamentary system. And the Council of Ministers of the European Union voted tentatively to reject the Parliament's amendments and then go even further. They described this as a compromise. I don't know who it was a compromise with. But we've already persuaded one country to reverse its vote. And if we get one more, then the Council of Ministers will sustain the Parliament's decision, and that will be at least final as far as this directive is concerned, that there will be no software idea patents in Europe. The European Patent Office has been issuing software idea patents, whose validity in any country is questionable because they're doing this in flagrant defiance of the treaty that set them up. They tried twice to get a vote to change the treaty, and they couldn't get it. Our movement played a role in making sure they couldn't get it. So they began disregarding the treaty. They came up with a rather silly excuse. But silly excuses like this are normal in the patent system. For instance, you'd think that it's supposed to be impossible to patent naturally occurring compounds. But then how is it that they patent in the U.S. natural genes? The patent system found an excuse. They said, well, the pure form of this gene has never been produced before. These bullshit excuses are normal with patent systems. They're constantly straining to extend patentability to everything, regardless of what laws say. The law for them, well, their attitude is like Humpty Dumpty. The law means what I want it to mean, no more and no less. So we need conclusive laws preventing software idea patents. But what do you do about existing software idea patents? I'm sad to say Australia already allows software idea patents. What it has to do is pass a law saying that no patent applies to the development or use or distribution of software running on fairly general hardware for input, computation, transmission, and display of data. And that way there would be no danger to computer users of being sued for the software that they develop or use. So, before I finish, as a way of finishing, I'd simply like to mention that I have somewhere, where is it? There's a yellow padded mailing bag. Where is it? Did I leave it back there? In that I have something that's not exactly on the subject of software idea patents. I've got some FSF things. I have stickers to give out, and I've got some pins and key rings to sell as a fundraising activity for the Free Software Foundation. but that's after I take questions. Oh, and by the way, you might notice I have some Pepsi here. Don't buy products of Coca-Cola Company. Coca-Cola Company murders union organizers in Colombia. See the site killercoke.org. And they're not talking about what's inside the Coca-Cola. They're talking about the other things the company does. By the way, a good website for an introduction to the issues of software idea patents is softwarepatents.co.uk. And if you want to find everything about the fight against software idea patents in Europe, look at ffii.org. And one analogy that can help you to explain the danger to people who don't understand programming is to imagine that in the 1700s, the governments of Europe had tried to promote the progress of music with a system of musical idea patents, allowing any idea, musical idea describable in words, to be patented. So, for instance, one could have patented the use of a certain four-note motif, or one could have patented a series of chords, or patented a formal structure for a movement, or a rhythmic pattern, or the use of certain instruments by themselves temporarily. Any idea describable in words could have been patented. Now imagine that it's 1800 and you're Beethoven and you want to write a symphony. You're going to find it's harder to write a symphony that you don't get sued for than to write a symphony that sounds good. Because to not get sued, you're going to have to thread your way through this thicket of thousands of musical idea patents. Being Beethoven, you wouldn't take this lying down. You'd complain in outrage. And the patent holders would say, oh, Beethoven, you're just jealous because we thought of these ideas first. Essentially using the fact that patents exist to put forward without question the assumption that one shouldn't be able to use ideas that someone else thought of first. So they'd say to Beethoven, go think of your own ideas, trying to suggest that somehow Beethoven wasn't capable of thinking of new ideas. In fact, Beethoven had a lot of new ideas, which is part of why he's considered a great composer. Some of his pieces were controversial because of the new ideas that they used, but he used them together with lots of old ideas so that he could make things that were recognizable as music, which is what enabled people to get used to his ideas so that today those pieces don't sound controversial to us. Nobody, not even a Beethoven, is such a genius that he can reinvent music from zero and make something people want to listen to. And it's the same for software. It's a good analogy here between a program and a symphony, because each one is a pile of lots of details. And to make it good is mainly a matter of getting all these details to work right, to fit together harmoniously. But these details implement ideas. But you don't just take an idea and drop it in. To implement an idea, you have to do it with lots of details, lots of notes or lots of lines of code. And what you put in there depends on all the rest. The way you implement one idea depends on all the rest of what you do in the symphony or the program. So these are good analogies, and they'll help make the problem clear to people. Literary idea patents might also help. You know, if you imagine writing a novel, well, there are lots of plot twists in one novel. There are lots of character elements in one novel. There are lots of style elements in one novel. So if you look through one novel, and once your eyes are open, you could find lots of potentially patentable literary ideas. Imagine what these literary idea patents would do to writing. They would make it grind to a halt. And these analogies are helpful because the politicians who make these decisions usually have never been programmers. If they've been programmers, it'll be obvious to them. They'll be on our side already. But most of them have never been programmers. So you have to show them what patents really do. They tend to think that a patent is the software developer's friend. They tend to think that if you've developed a program, you can patent it or get a patent on it. They don't realize there are going to be hundreds of patents in other people's hands that will be used to attack you first. They don't see that it's useless for you to get one or two patents if you're not allowed to develop the software at all because of the hundreds of other patents. They just don't realize it works this way. And they will say things like, or they will believe arguments when they're told them, like, the U.S. is number one in deploying computers, and the U.S. has software idea patents, so they must be a good thing. Well, the U.S. was in the lead in deploying computers in 1980 before it allowed software idea patents. Or they will say, if the U.S. has software idea patents and Australia does not, the U.S. will have an advantage. It's just the opposite. You see, each country has its own patent system, which regulates what goes on in that country and applies to activities in that country. So U.S. software idea patents restrict people who develop or distribute or use software in the U.S. And Australian software idea patents, if they're allowed, cover developing, distributing, and using software in Australia. So if the U.S. has software idea patents and Australia does not, that means that Australians can get U.S. software idea patents and attack us poor Americans at home. Everyone in the world can do that. But nobody can get an Australian software idea patent to attack Australians at home. So Australian software developers would have an advantage, and Australian software users would have an advantage. So Australia should get this advantage for itself and hope that the U.S. someday wises up. You know, of course, when the U.S. has a problem, the U.S. government doesn't try to solve the problem. Instead, it tries to impose the problem on the rest of the world. But fortunately, the U.S.-Australia Free Trade Agreement, for all the bad things in it, and it's nothing but bad, it doesn't say that there must be software idea patents. So Australia can try to pass a law curing the effect of these software idea patents and preventing more of them from being granted. And that's what it should do until it has the strength to tear up that treaty and other treaties. By the way, the TRIPS agreement also does not require software idea patents. TRIPS stands for Trade Restricting Impediments to Production, Education, and Science. And that's a part of the World Trade Organization. The World Trade Organization also is something that no country should belong to and countries should reject it. But I'm not saying they should impose tariffs. No, they could leave the WTO and say, we won't raise our tariffs as long as you don't. But fortunately, the World Trade Organization doesn't require software idea patents. Now, the reason that I use the name TRIPS instead of the official name is the official name uses the term, quote, intellectual property, unquote, which is a term we need to teach people to reject. Any organization, any government department, any academic department or lab that uses the name, quote, intellectual property, unquote, should change its name. So now I'm ready to take questions.
I'm a UML modeler. I'm working with the MAMS project in Macquarie, and the question is about patents and patterns. Reusable strategies of software engineering can be represented as patterns of programming. I'd like your thoughts on patents as they apply to patterns, and with a little.
I don't know, but you know, if this is a pattern that shows up in the software itself, then I'm sure they could be patented, and that would be another danger. If they're a pattern of activity in designing the program, then they might, nobody could ever prove that you had done it. They could never tell. So maybe they could probably get such patents, but in the U.S., I'm sure they could. The U.S. Patent Office will issue patents for any kind of thing. They issued a patent on a method for swinging sideways on a swing, but which is not quite as absurd as the recent Australian patent on the wheel.
Can I respond to the... A patent can be represented topologically in a graphical system like UML.
But that's not the point. The point is this pattern something that you would see in the program, or is it something that was a matter, or was it a pattern of people's thought processes as they were thinking about what to put in the program?
I'm not referring to a program. I haven't referred to a program. I'm talking about a unit, just as you talked about a strategy like the compression algorithm. I'm talking about the pattern as a high-level algorithm.
Well, if it's a pattern of things you would see, of things in the program, then yes, the use of that pattern could presumably be patented.
Hi, Kathy Barry from the Law Faculty at UNSW. You seem to be sending a bit of a mixed message, because on the one hand, you're sort of saying to engineers, it's a really bad system, stay away from it. On the other hand, you're saying you can't avoid it, it's going to bite you whatever you do.
No, I'm not saying stay away from it. I'm saying keep it out of your country. I'm not saying to people, ignore the patent system. In fact, when you're developing software, it's usually safest not to study what the patents are, but that doesn't keep you safe. It's just a little bit less dangerous than being, because of the laws that increase the penalties if they know you knew about the patents.
Just be pragmatic. I mean, we're going to have to live with it.
You don't have to live with it. I'm sorry. You're just not addressing what I'm talking about. I'm not interested in what you should do given that there are software idea patents. That's not my topic.
But what about the point? The engineers are a really crucial part of the system and making, as you said, it follows the system that gives the result. I mean,
the results are all bad.
Can I ask my question, please?
Yes, but I'm going to totally disagree with you.
You don't know what it is. What I'm saying...
Yes, I know what it is.
...is that the Patents Office has had to operate for 2 decades now with basically no documentation in biotech and computer software of what people have actually been doing. And it's not the only problem with the patent system, but part of the complete mess of the patent system is that the majority of the patents are bad. That happens across all fields, but particularly in this area. All the other areas of industry that you talk about are being different. One of the key differences is that there are centralized forms of documentation of what the priority is in those areas compared to this system. And so my question is, what is your responsibility as an engineer to provide forms of documentation?
Nothing. Nothing. It is a stupid thing to do, because that helps patent applicants design their patents, gerrymander their patents, so that they will be valid and dangerous. It is a stupid thing to do. The idea that the patent system could be made acceptable if we only gave the patent system more information is a foolish mistake. It's a trap. In fact, any idea that reforming the patent system might make it acceptable to have software idea patents is a terrible trap.
But it's not an foolish. It's not an argument about making it acceptable.
Well,
it's
don't waste your time. If somebody is actually – if you have possible – first of all, it is useful, of course, to publish things so that they will count as prior art.
That's what I'm talking about.
But publishing them in a magazine or on the web is enough. Publishing a program source code is enough.
But it's not for the patent office, because the patent office...
We don't want the patent office to have it.
Well, then they'll grant
it. Let me tell you why. Because if it's available in a central place, the patent office will use that to work with patent applicants so that they can draw the boundaries of their patents to avoid, if here's some prior art and the patent holder was thinking of getting a patent over here, which would have been vulnerable to that prior art, they'll draw the boundaries like this, so that it's not vulnerable to that prior art, and then we can't fight it later. So it's self-defeating.
But nobody can afford to fight them anyway.
You can sometimes afford to get them re-examined. And the point is, and some can afford to fight them. We need to save the prior art for when somebody's really opposing the patent, not make it available to help patent holders make patents that will stand up more. Because, you see, a patent that will... the idea that we want to, quote, improve patent quality, unquote, have patents that more of which will stand up, is a mistake. This is a distraction. You're focusing on a minor side issue. You know, this is like saying, you know, you're in a place with malaria, so let's all get together and swat mosquitoes. Well, we'll kill some mosquitoes that way. We might have somewhat fewer mosquitoes if we systematically keep swatting. Yes, we'll have fewer mosquitoes, and they'll be better quality because the mosquitoes that survive will be the ones that don't get swatted. But that won't cure malaria. So don't get taken in when people involved with the system who have lovingly studied the system ask you to help make the system work better. Working better is like, you know, suppose they issued only half as many patents. That's equivalent to having half as many mosquitoes flying around ready to give you malaria. That's not the way to make your country safe. Don't get distracted by half measures that, well, in their direct effects on the system, they might do half the job, but in the practical results, they change almost nothing. Suppose that the patent system had done a better job and issued only half as many software idea patents in the U.S. At that level, you'd say, oh, we've solved half the problem, but it really makes no practical difference. Suppose Linux, the kernel of our system, were covered by only 143 different patents instead of 286. It wouldn't really change things at all. We've got to do much more than fix half the problem. So don't get distracted by these half measures. Focus your efforts on a full solution. Europe shows that a movement can get going strong enough to convince legislatures. Don't think it's beyond our reach. Don't think we have to settle for half measures. That's a terribly foolish strategy.
But you can't convince your own government, so why would you expect us to be able to convince ours?
We don't have a movement in the U.S. We have one in Europe. So you can see an example of a country that's failing and an example of a country that's succeeding. So focus your efforts on really organizing.
Hi, my name's Rowan. I'm a lawyer in copyright, patents, and other completely unrelated fields. I have a question about the free software movement. Now, you've spoken about them as an effective lobby group in Europe.
No. We started the movement, but if it had been only us, we would never have been able to be so strong. You know, if we had said to the legislators, please protect free software, they wouldn't have considered free software so important. But because there's opposition coming from other software developers too, that adds up to something persuasive.
Yeah, my query is about how the free software movement's operating in Australia. It's certainly part of an effective lobby group in Europe, but not so much in the US from what you've told us. I'm wondering if the free software movement has an established presence in Australia at this stage.
Not that I know of. I mean, there are probably some user groups, but I don't know of any organization. And certainly I don't know of any organization to fight against software idea patents, and such an organization should be separate from free software. It shouldn't limit itself to free software developers or free software users. It should welcome everyone who is opposed to software idea patents. I hope that some of you will start one.
Hazel Moyer, I'm an economist from the ANU. I thoroughly enjoyed your talk, and I absolutely agree with you. And what I'm exercised about is how do we unravel it? Because we've actually had a recent inquiry here into the extension of patenting to business methods, where you can not merely patent an idea that's written down in code, but you can patent any other idea that's not written down in code at all, only a flowchart's what you need. And there were very few submissions. The Australian Consumer Association was almost the sole voice arguing against those interest groups who benefit from the patent system. But there were submissions, for example, from the US patent attorneys. They put in a submission. So did the international patent attorneys. So did lots of Australian patent attorneys. But now, what can we do? How can we galvanise enough people to get our legislators to get off their butts and change these decisions that are made in courts by judges where two private parties are arguing against each other and nobody is looking after the public interest? You've dismissed raising the inventive step just now. You've said you don't think that's effective. The only other thing it seems to me that TRIPS leaves us is to declare mathematical ideas, whether programmed or not, and so on, as not a field of technology. And there, but we've got to,
yeah.
A, find the technical way, and then we've got to get enough people off their butts
well,
to get
these
the
are two separate things.
Yeah.
The second one is not that hard. Just look at what they're doing in Europe. The first one is the hard part, and it starts with speeches like this. We've got to have people talking to other people about this problem. And again, Europe is a good example. We don't know. It's not clear whether we're ultimately going to win or lose. There's been a bit of good news lately. The European Parliament had to choose someone to be the lead in its response to the decision of the Council of Ministers. And they recently chose a person who is strongly against software idea patents. So this suggests that they are not taking kindly to having their decision overridden. And so they might suggest maybe at the second reading they will stand by their previous decision. They have to have more than 50% of the entire parliament to reject what the Council of Ministers does. But, you know, whether or not we win, we certainly will have come close. And that's a very good example to follow because, you know, whether you win or lose, if you're able to come close, then sometimes you're going to win.
Richard, just to clarify something here to make sure that I've read this correctly and that the audience is reading it that way too. The bounty quest idea, you've clearly indicated you don't think is a way forward. We've got to stop.
Well, actually, that's different.
Uh-huh.
Giving people bounties for sending in to you something that might be useful for defeating specific patents, that could be very good. Because, you know, I certainly say when somebody is really fighting a specific patent, then we should give him all possible help. What I'm against is trying to help the patent office, quote, do a better job, unquote. Because the very idea that this, quote, better job, unquote, makes things better in practice is what we have to reject. And we shouldn't get sucked into, I mean, by all means, swat a mosquito. If there's a mosquito around and you want to swat it, do so. At the very least, it'll slightly reduce your chances of getting malaria that day. Just don't think that this is the way to cure malaria.
So following on from that, another possibility in this fight back, apart from the fundamental fixing the patent system, is the possibility that we should have a really open public movement to get patents, lots of patents, and to, of course, then assign those into a public
foundation.
No,
that's right. Theoretically speaking, that could, you know, you could solve part of the problem that way. Suppose there were a patent pool joined by many software developers. And it had, and this pool said, anyone's welcome to be a member, even if he has no patents. But being a member means that any patents you have or get during that time are perpetually cross-licensed to everyone who is in the pool or joins it in the future. Well, if such a pool had enough patents, it could compel the mega corporations to join the pool. It might be a pool limited to software patents only, say. And if it got powerful enough that it could essentially compel the mega corporations to join, then a large fraction of all software patents would be licensed to this pool. But there would still be the patents that are in the hands of parasites, and you can't force them to cross-license. So, you know, it might turn out that, say, of all the patents covering Linux, 240 of them might be licensed to the pool. And of course, the developers of Linux, the kernel of our system, would join the pool. They have nothing to lose, right? They're not trying to attack anyone with any patents ever. So they'd be safe from those 240. And the other 48, well, suppose 20 of them are used to attack, and so they have to give up 20 features, and one of them is really important, so it's dead. So by all means, try to form this pool, but the problem is it's hard to get there. We've been talking about this for 15 years or so, and nobody sees how to make it get going. If it were big enough, sure, it could be self-sustaining. But while it's small, how do you get it going? How do you get anybody to join? And no one's been able to get it started, but maybe you could be the first.
Nick Abrahams from Deakin's Lawyers. Just a question that comes up when I'm advising Linux users, particularly.
They are GNU/Linux users, because you're not talking about the kernel by itself.
Okay. We've heard stories that in the States, certain large proprietary software companies have threatened large users of GNU/Linux users. GNU/Linux. Can you talk about whether you've had any first-hand experience of that? Whether there's any stories?
I have not. No one's ever threatened the Free Software Foundation. Of course, a lot of these threats are made in secret. In fact, I heard that Microsoft threatened some users of Samba and got them to make some concessions or pay some money or something without ever saying which patents they were threatening about. The Samba developers don't believe Microsoft's patents cover Samba, but the victim in this case never got a chance to even judge whether the patents really cover Samba, because it never found out which patents they were. Free software.
John Place, School of Computer Science and Engineering. I very much appreciated your talk, and I like the analogy of what might have been if we'd had musical idea patents some 300 years ago. To prevent the development of music. But I think there is a historical analogy that is more appropriate. It was forbidden to translate religious texts, and still is in some countries, except on the auspices of the Roman Catholic Church in Western Europe. And people were killed trying to translate even certain small sections of it, let alone the entire text.
I'm not sure that that's very analogous to the patent system and the way it works.
No, but what I was trying to say is that we shouldn't expect this to be a struggle that will be finished very quickly. It is a protracted struggle that will take years of struggle, and even if this particular struggle with the Council of Ministers is overturned in Europe, there'll be another attempt and another attempt.
Yes, I agree.
And for example, Paris yesterday announced that they are not going to go to a free software solution, which they'd been considering for the last 8 months.
And did they say why?
They said that the benefits, it would cost too much to do the transfer.
That's not related to the issue of patents, which was our subject today.
Yeah. Okay. But the idea is that the struggle is a protracted one.
Yes. But I want to avoid, since I'm speaking on an issue of concern to a lot more than just the free software community, I'm stating a position which is supported by many who do not use or develop free software, and therefore I don't want to turn it into a free software event. I don't want to put on my other hat. I feel that would be detrimental to the cause I'm trying to serve today.
I'm going to take one last one because we're at the witching hour. Somebody wipe this here, please.
Oh, there's another option. That's a defense for infringement for free and open source software from patents, so any developers or users. Free and open source software would then carte blanche be able to use patents and have.
Well, you could imagine a law saying that.
Very easy to make that amendment. We recently introduced a new Designs Act in Australia, Designs for Visual Features Act, and there was an amendment for manufacturers of spare parts, so they would be excuse from infringement. Very easy thing to do.
Well, if you can do it, do it. It's just that what I've seen is we've had a better chance getting laws, you know, in Europe at least, where the fight's been going on. It seems we were clearly have a better chance of preventing software idea patents entirely than getting an exception for free software. And the reason is, if you find in Australia that there's a chance to do that, do it, please. But what we decided to do was go for a full solution, since the full solution would get support from more people. If it was just the free software community asking for, please give us an exception, well, first of all, it really looks like asking for an exception. And second, the free software community was small, not big enough to persuade people to do anything. But because we're asking for something that helps every computer user and most software developers, we get broader support and thus got powerful enough to persuade the parliament. Whether we could have, no one knows the alternate universe in which the free software community alone had asked for an exception for itself. I can't tell you I'm certain we would have failed, but I don't think we would have got as far as we've got on such a narrow base. But I don't know the conditions in Australia that well. It's certainly very different from the European Union. You know, I, as a free software developer, would be glad if free software at least were exempted from software patents.
Would you be happy enough with that?
Well, but, you know, I with my free software hat would be happy with that, but you'll find a lot of software developers that won't be happy with that. And they would, you know, they'd be better off if the software idea patents if they were all shielded from patents. And, you know, as I said, I'm not an expert on Australian conditions. I'm the wrong one to try to judge what has a chance of success.
Obey my own rules and actually have a microphone. The first one is that there's a conference coming up on the 18th and 19th of November, which is going to do exactly what it was that that Richard wanted in one particular respect. It's called Unlocking IP, and of course the theme will be getting people to stop thinking about intellectual property and to start thinking about unlocking. There will be details, samples of these brochures on the table as we leave. The second thing I want to deal with is that it's possible that there are some media people in the room who may be hoping to talk with Richard. We believe there is a possibility of this. The huddle will be in this corner here with David doing the organising in the event that there is any such desire. Please don't rush out at Richard. Please rush to that corner if there are such people here. It's not that we don't like you. We just want this under control. Third thing I've got to deal with is that, as mentioned, sales of SFF materials will be at the desk, and just before he talks to any media, Richard will go across and advise David what sorts of numbers are associated with each of these particular things. We have that little bit of logistics to organise in the process.
We've got these pins and key rings, and each of them is $20.
Great, and they will be on that corner of the table, this very end of the table, so that other people can actually get out and down the stairs.
And here are some stickers.
And they're also $20.
No, these are gratis, but take what you can actually use.
I suppose we should ask whether they're Malaysian dollars or Australian dollars or American dollars.
Australian.
Australian dollars, good. The fourth thing is that it's quite clear that there's going to be a number of anti-software ID patent movements formed in this room. Will you please do that in this corner over here? And if there are too many people, we will move some chairs and expand the space. Quite seriously, there's a number of different threads here. That last one was a bolt out of midair that I hadn't picked up before, not being a lawyer, not knowing much about the Designs Act. That's another angle entirely. And I know a little bit about this topic. So that's now four movements that I think we've got to form in this corner here. And the fifth and last thing is pretty obvious, which is to ask you to join me in thanking Richard very much for his presentation. Thank you.